I'm Bob Bazans, and I'm an alcoholic. To the grace of God and the power of AA, and having a drink to the 10th of December, 1967. And for that, I'm very grateful. It's nice to be back in Atlanta. I had a very memorable occasion when I was asked to speak here at this conference before. My son Peter came, and he was greatly impressed and spent some time around John and Mariama and Dick, and that was a very special memory that I had. I was going to try to, if I remember why Peter can't be here, I will explain that later. I was going to try to bring Peter. I'm traveling with a dear friend of mine, Bill Taylor, and I'm grateful that we both have a chance to be here this weekend. I was a delegate with Joe P. That's a memory I have of Atlanta, Joe Phelan, and a real character and an interesting man and a guy that I like that, you know, you two fellows have gone to every roundup. There is, there's something wonderful about persisting. You know, one of the things I liked about AA when I first came, and I was 23 when I came, is I wanted to hang out with the big guys. You know, I mean, I was like a kid in AA, and I'm glad the big guys are still coming. That's because I don't think that changes. I really do think that the attendance and participation and of the people that have 20 or 30 or plus or 40 years or 52 years is important. So I'm grateful that you do that. I'm looking forward to the other speakers. I'm sorry I missed Mickey, and I'm looking forward to hearing Kathy and Howard. And Cecil is a very special man to me. That man and about two or three other Canadians, I'm from St. Paul, Minnesota, not Minneapolis, and we're kind of the Fort Worth of the thing. And when I grew up in AA, my sponsor Warren and Joe W. Got us active, and we went to conferences. And there were about four or five guys from Canada that were just unbelievable workhorses in Alcoholics Anonymous. And this man that you're going to hear tomorrow night, you probably will not, in the course of his talk, understand all the contributions that man has made. It was just, those guys made service look fun. Those guys were out on the road a lot. And they sacrificed a lot of their lives to do that. And they taught us. And I really feel like I was in your school, as I was in Tommy's and Tom Grafton and Terry Penton, and, you know, they were in Mac Cheater. I mean, those men just had an influence on us in Minnesota and a few of us that I think changed their lives. And you're going to hear a war horse tomorrow night, and a man that's made a great contribution. And thank Dick for introducing me. I admire Dick. You're one of the hardest working members of AA that I know, and that's not a bad thing. I started drinking when I was 14 years old. I was a freshman in high school. 4'11" and weighed 95 pounds, mostly mouth. And I was just one of those insecure kids, you know, I wanted everybody's attention. I felt, you know, I was always trying to do something to get your attention. It always seemed like everybody else got to school an hour early and held a meeting, and I always missed the meeting. You know, they always kind of decided what was going to go on for the day, and it seemed like they knew when I didn't know. And I was always kind of comparing myself with their outsides and my insides, as Cecil used to say. And I got to be a marginal member of the in-group, was about as good as it got. I went to a military high school and a college campus. We drank in high school like most people drink in college. We had fraternities. We were a Catholic school. I never knew that Catholics drank a lot. I don't know if we drink a lot more than anybody else, but if we're going to have a contest, I'm going for my people. But I can remember that, you know, the first time I took a drink, hell, I didn't feel like I was a member of the group. I felt like I owned it. I mean, it was not like a minor change. It was a major shift in how I saw things. I mean, it was really a transformation. There's no other word for it. I drank my brains out in high school. Almost died of alcohol poisoning, a couple of car accidents, got arrested a few times. Of my five closest friends in high school, four of us are in AA, and one's in Al-Anon, and two of the wives are in AA. So, I mean, and we were, and most of us have been friends since we've been 10 years old. This wasn't, we just didn't pick each other because we drank. I mean, that's an odd, you know, collusion of things. And I got a reputation as a drinker, and I got into a lot of trouble. By the way, I want to report to you there is such a thing as karma. My wife and I have three boys. They are 35, 32, and 23, and all are in the program. And I've turned my wife in as a carrier. But they have 16, 13, and 6 years of sobriety, and it would be almost impossible to explain how grateful we are for that blessing. But there is such a thing as karma. You get to experience it from the other side. I didn't think I had a drinking problem. I thought I had an age problem. I thought I was underage and I got into a lot of trouble. I was unlucky and I got caught a lot. And when I got caught by my father or the police, it didn't matter how many drinks you had. It was only the matter that you were drinking. So I was happy to get away from home and go away to school. Thought my drinking would normalize. It didn't. I drank my way out of the University of Notre Dame, middle of my senior year. My middle boy has been to six colleges, so you get to experience that on the other side, too. I walked out. I was in the yearbook, had my class ring, walked out, you know. I was the class drunk. They used my room as a study hall. I was due to be commissioned in the Army when I got out. I had to get a medical release. The medical release I got was for alcoholism. I was diagnosed an alcoholic when I was 19. That seemed inaccurate. It seemed impossible. My parents were just looking for what's wrong. Why is this kid trying to kill himself? Why is this kid in so much trouble? And everybody's looking for an answer, and we ran into a psychiatrist who knew a little bit about alcoholism, and I didn't think that was... I remember when he diagnosed me, I went back to school. I went to the library first and got a book on alcoholism, but it was a Freudian-based book, and it related alcoholism to latent homosexuality. Dealing with two sizable issues at once was not something that I was willing to do. You know, we joke about those things, but that was a sad deal for me walking out of school. Going to that school was a big deal for me. You know, see that movie Rudy? He went to Notre Dame. I passed through. I never got to have the experience. My brother was magna cum laude. He went. I didn't. I just, you know. I went back there some years later and gave an AA talk, and I was in the auditorium. I went to make amends to a couple of people who didn't remember me, which helped me put in context how important I was. And I was giving the talk, and in the middle of my talk, I said, I've always had a deep sense of failure about this place, and I said, I just figured out why. I said, I think it's because I failed. But it wasn't cute. I mean, I can, you know, being a parent in that situation, I can see what I put my parents through. And I left school, came home, finished at a local university. When I finished school, my dad said, Bob, you got to leave. He said, we love you, but you're just a pain in the neck. And it's not, you know, I was one of seven kids. He said, you're just a bad example. You just can't be here anymore. I went out and I got a job at a liquor store. And have to use your gifts. And... this is the last year of my drinking. So I worked at the liquor store for about 6 months. I'm drinking a fifth a day. I'm, you know, 6 days a week. I get in trouble. I get, you know, a ticket for going 80 miles an hour with a delivery truck. I lose that job. I go get a job as a waiter. I'm living on... not Skid Row, but close, you know, $7-$8 a night rooms. I'm shacked up with waiters and waitresses. You know Dr. Seuss, that child author? Those are actual photographs of people I live with during the last year of my drinking. And I'm going to work at 10, and, you know, I'm going to work at 11 in the morning and drink a couple of beers and take a, you know, a Dexedrine or something. I go to work. I work from... 11 to 2. At 2, I go to a bar and drink beer. At 5, I go buy a fifth or a pint. And I go back and work as a waiter, and then I figure out where I'm going to live for the night. I did that for about 6 months, and then one night I went to a party, and I got my face kicked in, and they wouldn't let me continue to work as a waiter looking the way I looked, and they fired me. And I had no place to go. I was tapped. My parents probably hadn't seen me in 4 or 5 months, and I'm I went back to the house and asked if they would let me come back to the house. And they said, yeah, if I wouldn't drink. I lied. I said that I wouldn't drink. I started to go through withdrawal. It never occurred to me you could get in trouble not drinking. But if you're drinking a lot for a long time, I started to, you know, I drank my way out of that. When I moved back in the house, I tried to rearrange my life. You know, I think if you would have asked my dad what he wanted for me and asked me what I wanted for me, they would have been the same answers. But if you would have asked my dad if he thought I wanted what he wanted for me, I mean, he thought I was killing myself. I mean, he thought I was trashing everything. You know, having lived the other side of that, I understand it a little bit better. So when I moved back in the house, I got back together with Linda, who's my lovely wife, who, and the reason Bill's with me instead of Linda is we became grandparents 2 weeks ago. And very cool experience. And so she's home attending to that a little bit. My wife has been active in Al-Anon 37 years this month, and it's been a great partnership. I'd like to think we'd be married if we both were not of the fellowship, but I wouldn't bet on it. My story is kind of tacky. I had trouble even in sobriety, and I know that most of you haven't. And and I think with the troubles we had in our life, if we would have turned the lasers on each other, we would have melted each other. And because we each had a program, we turned them on ourselves. We looked at our own part, and that's been a, you know, it's been a great deal. So I got back together with Linda. I got a job as executive trainee in a manufacturing concern. I bought my first car, and I thought, wow, it's finally going to happen. Only it didn't happen. I couldn't shut my drinking down. I'm a bar drinker, and I'm out every night. And big corporations are tough places. They like to have you come in on Mondays and stay on Fridays, and they've got schedules. And now I'm the company drunk. I'm in a company of engineers, and I'm like Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. I'm falling asleep at my desk, and I'm sleeping off hangovers in the dark room, and it was not good. And I just can't shut it down, and I quit that job. I had that job about 6 months, and I took a sales job. Thought a sales job would give me a little more flexibility. And and I was into that sales job about 5 weeks, and a buddy of mine got married, and weddings were always kind of good for about a week. And I woke up some Thursday in July of 1967, haven't been to work in 3 days. I called in the first 1 or 2 days, but not the last day. And just, it was like someone, you know, put those chargers on your chest, you know, to kind of wake you up. And I didn't know if I had a job, a fiancé, or a place to live until I was married, and that was an economic necessity. And all of a sudden, the recommendation of my father and my psychiatrist that I call AA didn't seem so impossible, and I called Alcoholics Anonymous. They sent two guys out to see me. You know, as soon as I called, I found out I still had a job, and found out Linda was still talking to me, and found out my parents were concerned rather than mad. And I thought, why the hell did you call AA? You know, kind of an overreaction, you know. But I wanted to go see what an alcoholic looked like, so I went to the cafe to meet these two guys. One guy had 6 months, one guy had 6 years. They introduced themselves to me, and they said, we're from AA, we had a drinking problem, we found an answer in AA. And they said, we hope if you have a problem that you can be helped by what we say, but for some reason it helps us to go talk to people. You know, they weren't getting a toaster for signing me up. It wasn't a multi-level marketing deal. It was just a 12-step call. And those two men shared their story with me, and in the sharing of their lives with me, they changed my life. We have many traditions in AA, one of the most wonderful ones of which is that we share our experience, strength, and hope, and not just our ideology or our philosophy. I had, in trying to get me help, my parents had brought me to a pretty long list of different people to help me. Doctors, lawyers, judges, Indian chiefs, psychiatrists, bishops, nuns, priests, you know, long list. But I had never in that list of people talked to anybody who had a drinking problem. I was always kind of the subject of the conversation, and this was an entirely different thing, and those men told their drinking story, and in the middle of that, I started to identify, and by the end of it, I started to share things about myself that I hadn't shared with anybody, and I went to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous that night. I drank twice after coming to AA. Once after 30 days of sobriety, I went on a training trip to California, and I was told to call AA when I got off the plane, and I didn't, and I told everybody I had a $100 bet, and I wasn't drinking. That kept me sober the first week, but not the second, and I got in some trouble, and came back, and then I was sober just about 3 months, and we got married. And I think in the back of my mind, it was more subconscious than planning. We honeymooned in Mexico, and I drank on our honeymoon in Mexico. You know where the divers dive off those cliffs in Mexico? I dove off those cliffs on my last drunk. And I was in the audience watching a world's high diving contest. I thought, God, that's not so tough. And I went over. President Aleman was there, or the ex-president Aleman. His nephew had been my roommate. I'm just dead drunk. I'm over there trying to talk to him, and they're trying to. So I go over, I walk down, I dive off the public landing, and I climb up the cliff, and I'm up at 85 or 90 feet, and I'm stuck. I split my swimsuit, I cut my leg. My wife is going absolutely nuts. And now I'm stuck. I can't climb down. And I'm too drunk. I could almost barely, you know, just barely climb up. And I'm trying to decide whether to jump or dive, and I finally said, out of the hell with it, and I dove, and God watch it after fools and drunks, because I made it. There's an old-timer in AA by the name of Norm A, and he used to talk about seconds and inches. But for seconds and inches, this room would be empty. But for an overdose, but for a car accident, that, you know, but for a, you know, but for prison, but for, you know, many of us would not be in this room but for seconds and inches. Had I jumped, I would have died. I didn't know that. I didn't know it, and might have known it intuitively, but I didn't know it informationally. And you have to get out about 30 feet to do that. As time went on, we took the kids down there quite a bit to that hotel for vacation. And on my 10th anniversary, Linda gave me a picture of that cliff at La Quebrada, and it said, "There but for the grace of God." And we were out there one night watching the divers, and I said, "God, that's the dumbest thing I ever did." And she said, "Bob, it's not even in the top 10. So I don't know how two people can share a life and see it so differently. So I'm pretty much done talking about my drinking. And sometimes when we talk about episodes or things that happened to us, and, you know, they're kind of funny. But mostly drinking wasn't very funny. Mostly it was just tacky. It was everything from messing my trousers to getting arrested to walking in, having the police bring you home, to having your parents meet you at the door, to having a fight with your father, to having a family meeting where your sisters and mother are crying and the family's trying to figure, you know, your brothers want to beat the hell out of you and they're trying to figure it out. What do you do with this guy? We love him, but we hate him. We don't know what to do with him. And, you know, you behave in the poorest way with women, as an employee, as a son, you're just as tacky. I mean, it is just as tacky as it can be. So it isn't very spectacular. It isn't very funny. Most of it is just tacky. So I don't want, that's more what I would like to leave you with. And when I came back off my honeymoon, I went back to the meeting and I turned myself into my sponsor. I have the same sponsor that I got when I walked in the front door of Alcoholics Anonymous 36 and a half years ago. My sponsor will have 50 years of sobriety on August 21st. And and he's a wonderful member of AA. He was a postman. I would have liked to have had an attorney, but I got a man. There couldn't have been a better man to sponsor me, and his wife sponsored my wife. We almost have a father and son relationship. It isn't maybe the relationship you might think of the traditional. We're family today as much of anything. But most of what, I've been a pretty active member of AA. I've gotten to be a delegate. I've gotten to give AA talks. I sponsor different people. Most of whatever I've accomplished or experienced in Alcoholics Anonymous has been from following Warren. You know, just doing what Warren did, taking me out in calls and getting me active in roundups and having me be the five-minute speaker. Our group would go to another group and we'd put on a meeting and, the new kid would be the five-minute speaker and he was the 12-step champion of our group. We had a very large group. We call them squads in Minnesota. There were about 200 people that met in the group, but you were like Thursday night, squad. And I think Warren took about a third of all, or 20% of all the AA calls that came in. And so we got to do a lot. We had a lot of great experiences, and he's a wonderful man and still an active member of AA. And when I came back, I thought, okay, I got it. I'm an alcoholic. But I got some other issues, you know, along with my alcoholism. And if I've got the problem and you got the answer, you ought to help me resolve those issues, and I'll be reasonable. It might take a year. They haven't been totally resolved yet. The problems I had were kind of horrible but ordinary. I had trouble getting up in the morning. And I later found out that it had something to do with when I went to bed, but at the time I did not know that. I had some financial difficulty. I spent about $300 more a month than I made. Now, if you do that over a long period of time, you're going to end up in debt. I just want to report that to you in case you're running that one and you don't know where it goes. I used to say I didn't have marital problems, but Linda said, yes, you did. You just didn't notice it. And, and then when we started to have children, I had parenting issues. I had a great mom and dad, but even good parents make mistakes, and I wasn't going to make the mistakes my parents made, and I didn't. I made all the mistakes they made and a bunch they hadn't thought of. I was loud, impatient, angry, immature, and sometimes violent with my children. I am not proud of that. I've been helpful in breaking the cycle of alcoholism in our family. I have a brother that's sober, and a cousin, and some nephews, and three boys. And what I'd like to also be part of is breaking the cycle of rage that's in our family. And I often thought, had I continued to be inappropriate, wouldn't it have been wonderful for my kids to have the disease of alcoholism and not have wanted to come to AA because of how I was, because of how the big AA guy was, the guy who gives all the talks. Wouldn't that have been a neat deal that my boys had the disease but didn't want my answer, or our answer? And not good. And I had a gambling problem, more of a hobby. Four or five hours a day, 4 or 5 days a week. It wasn't a big deal. I was making about $5,000 a year playing backgammon. It was kind of like a second job. I had all these problems in my first year of sobriety, and I never noticed them. None of the issues I just said to you were on my first inventory. So uninsightful. My first inventory was more about the horrible things I had done in my life. And it wasn't particularly, it never got into the causes and conditions. It was the best I knew how to do it. I wouldn't go back and change that first, fourth, and fifth step, but it just wasn't, I didn't have much insight. It wasn't until later. I didn't have a very good list of my defects of character even through my first year of sobriety. I was on kind of a honeymoon during my first 9 months in AA. It was magical. I had a surrender experience, and it was just magical. And then about 9 months into it, my ego started to reassert itself, and I got a little less teachable. And by the middle or end of my second year, I had a pretty good list of my defects of character, and I started to attend to them. And I'd make a little progress, and then I'd go backwards. I'd make a little progress, and I'd go backwards. And I'm glad I didn't get to the list all at once. It kind of came to me over a period of time. And by my third and fourth year, my defects of character were causing me discomfort. By my fifth and sixth year, they were eating my lunch. By my seventh and eighth year, it was not good. I'm going to talk a little bit about problems in sobriety. And I don't want to give you the impression that my sobriety was horrible. It wasn't horrible. It was just, you know, when you're talking in retrospect, you know, when you get your first year cake, you thank people for saving your lives and how wonderful it was. Then when you get your third year cake, you tell them how sick you were in the first year. Because you now have permission and some perspective to look back and kind of see how it was. And that's what I'm doing. I have the freedom to have some perspective on what I went through, and I'm just kind of sharing that with you. There's always been progress. There's always been some growth. There has been serious problems. I don't want to give you the impression that I didn't have serious problems. I did. But we don't come here unflawed. And you don't get it all done in the first one or two or three years. I mean, we make spectacular progress, but I'm telling you, you don't get it all done. And most of us have a second block of work that we have to do that most of us aren't ready to do until we've got a pretty good chunk of sobriety behind us to attend to it. And by my seventh year, I'm in a lot of pain. I'm back in as much debt as I was when I came in. When I came in, I was a year and a half salary in debt, and I was able to pay that off over a 2 or 3 year period of time, and now I'm 7 years sober and I'm back in debt. And I'm, you know, the new, I'd be at the AA club and the new guy would come in with a bushel basket full of manure they have, you know, and they'd tell me about the wife and the job and the cops and the money, and I'd say, hey, as hopeless as it is and as bad as it seems, you're in the right place. You know, sit down, get a cup of coffee. See that guy over there? God, his life was just horrible 3 years ago, and now he's knocking it out of the park. If you stay here and you get a book and you get into the book and you get into the steps and you get a sponsor, you're going to be okay. And then I'd get in the car and I'd go home and I'd say, Bob, when are you going to be okay? You just charged a $400 sport coat at a store that you had a $1,200 bill at today. When are you going to stop doing that? When are you going to learn how to work? Everybody knows how to work except you. When are you going to learn how to work? When are you going to be more gentle with your children? When are you going to be more loving with your wife? When are you going to quit gambling? I didn't have a very good answer for that. When I came into AA, one of the first things that happened to me was I had built a wall up around me. Well, my sponsor told me very early on in Alcoholics Anonymous that alcoholism was a disease, that it was threefold, mental, physical, and spiritual. And that once we crossed the line from problem drinking to alcoholism, my alcoholism affected me all the time, when I drank and when I didn't drink. The idea that alcoholism could affect me when I wasn't drinking was a brand new idea. That was like rocket science to me. And he said, what we do in Alcoholics Anonymous, once we take our last drink of alcohol, is we use the steps to change. The steps are the program. The program's about change. If you don't change, you're not going to stay. The change is about finding something in sobriety that allows you to stay sober, finding something you're looking for that you don't have to go back to drugs or booze to do something for you that you're unwilling or unable to do for yourself. You got to change. And I'm glad he told me that. I remember how confused I was because I'd go to the meetings. I'd go early and I'd stay late. I'd come home at midnight. I didn't want to miss anything. And I'd listen to those men talk to their sponsors, and they weren't talking about not drinking. There was a little of that. But they were talking about having a fight with their wife or trouble at work or how to pay bills and how to do amends, and it was very little talk about how not to drink. The assumption was you're not drinking and you don't want to drink. I mean, the conversation was, how do we now live in such a way that we don't have to go back to drinking? So I got in our meetings in Minnesota at that time were 95% closed-step discussion meetings. That they now we have a much broader variety of meetings, but at that time, I'm telling you, if you went any place to a meeting in St. Paul or Minneapolis, we had the squads like we had at 2218, and there'd be 30 people in a room, and you'd give the step, and then we'd go around the table, and we'd talk about the step. And so now I'm, you know, I had a wall built up before I came into Alcoholics Anonymous so that you couldn't see what was going on. The thinking that went on behind the wall said, you like me, but you only like what I let you see about me. If you could see everything about me, you'd hate me because I hate me. And who knows more what a lousy, crummy, insufficient person I am than me. I'm walking around comparing my inside with your outside. The only way you come out doing that is second best. But at some point in time, I got tired enough, hurt enough, afraid enough that I tore that wall down and I said, hey, come and get me. I don't care who you are, where you come from, but just come and get me and help me not be who I am anymore. I can't stand me 5 more minutes. When I tore the wall down, I made a discovery that was vital for my recovery. And the discovery was that I'm not unique. Most of us come in here with a profound, overdeveloped sense of uniqueness and difference. If you don't lose some of that, you're not probably going to stay because you're going to look for the differences rather than the similarities. Okay? When I tore the wall down, I made a discovery. I'm not unique. My personality may be unique, but not my illness, not my behaviors, not my problems, not my feelings. And I started to get a sense of hope that maybe what worked for you could work for me. When I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, what I wanted to find was an expert on Bob. I wanted to find someone who could look through my soul and discern what was wrong with my life. Because I was a guy who should have done pretty well, and I just never quite put it together. I never found that person. What happened to me is I surrendered and I became an alcoholic. When I became an alcoholic, I didn't have one person looking at me. I had 25 teachers who knew a lot about alcoholism and how to recover from alcoholism, and they gave me insight into myself and into my life through the workings of the program. And it was a profound year. I made an enormous amount of changes in my first year, as many of us do. But as time went on, when I started to have these problems in sobriety, I was a year and a half sober, and I'd have a problem that I didn't think I should have a year and a half sober. Everybody's telling me how good I was. I'd say, thank you very much for helping my drinking problem, but stay out of my sex life. Thanks a lot for helping my drinking problem, but stay out of my marriage. Stay out of my parenting. Stay out of my gambling. Stay out of my work. Brick by brick, sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, I built the damn wall back up. Because I didn't want people to ever, my sponsors telling me how good I'm doing. I'm saying, God, can't you see? Well, my sponsor didn't expect me to be perfect. I was the one that expected me to be perfect. Now that I'm sponsoring younger guys, Warren knew I had problems. But I didn't want anybody to see. I didn't know I was building the wall up with glass. I thought it was brick. But I found myself 7 or 8 years sober in Alcoholics Anonymous feeling isolated and feeling like a failure and feeling like I had a good, I didn't know what the hell to do. Do I have to go to Gamblers Anonymous? Do I have to go to Spenders Anonymous? Do I have to go to Anger Anonymous? And I'm thinking, if I ever got to go to a program for every problem I have, I'm going to be a busy guy. But I felt ashamed. I felt like I was, a great starter and a poor finisher. I felt ashamed. And I knew what the answer was. The two things that have saved my bacon in AA is I can't keep my mouth shut, so I usually over some period of time tell people what's going on. And the other one was that I've had great teachers in AA, and I've always been attracted to the older member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and that has, I think, been a... So I knew what the answer was. The answer was to find a deeper, better spiritual dimension in my life. But I had a problem. You go knock on the door, and God says, who's there? And you say, God, it's Bob. And he said, what do you want? I said, I want to turn myself in. I'm 7 years sober. My pants are on fire, and I need some help. Then I'm going to say to God what all sponsees say to their sponsors when they're really in trouble. What do I do? And you don't have to be a rocket scientist to figure out what God's going to tell me to do. Get up in the morning. Go to work. Stay at work. No idea. Work at work. Another new idea. Get on a budget. God, budget. I mean, that's an Al-Anon word. That is a tough word. Quit gambling. Be kind and loving to your children and be kind and loving to your wife. Well, I'm going to say, hell, if I could do all those things, I wouldn't need God. I was kind of... What do you think I've been trying to do for the last 7 years? So what's the use of going to God to develop a relationship if you can't fulfill the conditions of the relationship? My idea was, as soon as I clean my act up, I'll go to God because I can't... It wouldn't work the other way. And I was stuck in that place for almost 2 years, from about year six or five or six to about year eight. I was thinking about suicide. I wasn't thinking about drinking, but I was thinking about suicide. And so, it was not like I was just unhappy. It was not good. And finally, out of desperation, I went back into the steps. I hadn't been away from them so much, but this time I thought, I'm going to go through. I've been through the steps twice formally, and I thought, this time I'm going to go through, and I'm going to dot the I's, cross the T's, And I looked at the first step, 8 years sober, and I said, boy, baby, that was easy. I am powerless, and I am unmanageable. That was easy. What surprised me? The second step. I could have put my hand on a lie detector, and you would have said, Bob, do you believe God's going to restore us to sanity? I'd say, yes. The needle would not have moved. If you would have asked me, do I think God's going to restore Bob Bazan's sanity? The answer is no. I'm on the down escalator walking up. Every time I take a breath, I lose about 3 steps. I'm going backwards. It's getting worse, not better. Now, that was an illusion. What had happened to me is that you started to get me more honest, less able to deny what was going on in my life. You got me more in touch with my values. And what I was doing was marching on in my recovery, bumping into what didn't work, which is what the path of a spiritual journey is. The process of finding God and the process of recovery is a process of removal, not addition. It's a process of coming home, not going someplace else. And when you're in trouble, you get more active, and I got more active, and all of a sudden I started to see people with bigger problems than I had, with smiles on their faces and great dignity, walking through walls that I was trying to avoid. And I came to believe, again, that God would restore Bob to sanity. I took my third step on my knee with my sponsor in his office. We didn't do that much in those days, but I thought, what the hell? I started to be exposed to different ideas because I was attending conferences, and that was one of the newer ideas that I had. It was a new old idea. And then I did a fourth step, my third, and I did my third fifth step with my sponsor. And up till that time, the tradition in our area was to do it with clergy. But again, because I started to be exposed to newer ideas, more and more people were doing them with their sponsor, and I thought, I'm going to do that. I said, when you're done, be careful, because I'm going to do whatever you recommend. I said, I feel like I'm dying of thirst lying next to a lake. I said, I feel like there's a plastic wall between me and the lake. I said, if you gave me a test and asked me what to do, I could pass the test. I just can't do it. And I said, I'm so God damn sick and tired of that. I said, I just can't tell you how sick and tired of that I am. And I did my fifth step, and we cried a little and talked a little. And then what he recommended to me, he said, Bob, you have a lot of problems with money. You have a lot of problems with work. You have a lot of problems with failure. You have a lot of problems with success. And I would like you to go to an industrial psychologist. And I got a recommendation from someone, and I went to the psychologist, and I called him up. I did not want to do that. I felt like an admission of failure. Hello. And he said, can you get your parents involved? I said, no. I said, my parents have been over-involved in my life, and if you can't help me without getting them involved, could you recommend me to someone who couldn't? He said, well, you get your wife involved. I thought, oh, crap. Well, they see it so differently, you know, it's probably more accurately. He said, well, you get your children involved. And I thought, well, I did not want my kids involved. I mean, when you're abusive or you don't, you know, I was ashamed of that. I did not want my children involved. And I said, yeah, I'll get them involved. So we started going to the psychologist, and I was in the process about the eighth week. I don't know how long I went to him, maybe 4 or 5 months. And I'm in there, and we're talking about my business is failing, and I'm about to go under, and I don't know. I'm busting my ass 2 or 3 hours a day, and I don't know why it's not working. And it's and the psychologist looked at me, and he said, why are you so afraid of failing? And I wanted to pull his nose right off his face. And I said, look, jerk, I explained. I said, you're a doctor. I said, when you fail, you just take your little sign, walk down the door, walk down the hall, pound it on a different door, and within 6 months you're making $100,000 again. I said, I'm in the investment business. I'm about to go broke, and I'm going to lose, everything I have. I said, nod your head up and down if you understand that. I said, I'm going to lose everything I have. And he looked at my wife, and he said, if Bob lost everything he had, would he lose you? And my wife said, nope. Wouldn't lose me. He looked at Billy and Peter, and he said, if your dad lost everything he had, would he lose you? And the kids said, no, it wouldn't lose us. You know, if you can't lose, you can't play. Now, I'm a guy, if we were going to have a marathon, I'd have a great pair of tennis shoes and a good pair of shorts. I'd look and talk and act like a runner. I'd tell you that I won some race in Minnesota, and you'd expect that I would be in the top 10 in the race. And when the race started, I'd be in the top 10 for the first 25% of the race. But sometime between a third and three quarters of the race, I'd fall down, hurt myself, and I wouldn't finish the race. When the race was over, they'd say, what happened to that guy from Minnesota? And they said, gee, I don't know. Hell of a guy. Won some race in Minnesota. He must have pulled a hamstring or something. But if you would have followed me around in a helicopter for the last 10 years of my life, you could have guessed within 50 feet of when I would have fallen down, because I don't finish anything. You know, great start in my church, don't continue. Great start in my family, don't do a very good job. Great start in school, don't finish. I interview well, I just don't work well. It is... They should have some prizes for interviewing. And and what I got in touch with at the psychologist was how afraid I was. Up to, and I've done 3 4-steps, and I don't know that I'm afraid. I've got tall buildings, dogs, snakes, you know, a few things in my inventory, but I didn't do a very good fear inventory. I'm afraid of being a husband. I'm afraid of the responsibility. I'm afraid of being a father. I remember the first time Linda told me she was pregnant. I thought all I saw was half our income going away. I mean, that was my first reaction. You can't be pregnant. You know, I mean, it was just fear. I mean, I had no sense that it was, you know, I know today that no one has enough money to have a baby. I mean, none of us, none of us did when we started having our families. It's just the nature of the beast. And God provides, and the world provides. You're doing what you're supposed to be doing. I was afraid of failure. I was afraid of success. I did not know that, but I was. It was like the fish in the sea. It was invisible to me. What's the sea? You know, I was swimming in it and didn't know it. Not too long after that, I was in my living room. I had had a bad day. I got up late, went to work late, left early, got in the backgammon game, won $400, missed dinner, missed the A group, came home, got in a fight with Linda and slapped one of the kids. One of those days you'd like to have videotaped and sent to the General Service Office to show what 8 years can do. And just kind of worried that your sponsor might walk in any moment, you know, and see how it really is. And I'm in my living room reading some non-conference approved literature. And I'm reading the other big book. And I'm hurting. And I said, gee, it happened again. And I said, what do you mean it happened again? Weren't you there? And I said, yeah, I was there. But I said, it's so habitual. It's kind of like I'm in a blackout. It's kind of like these patterns are so deep, I don't even have to think about them. They just happen all by themselves. And all of a sudden, I realized that was a bunch of crap. When I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, I surrendered. And when I surrendered, I stood naked in front of a mirror and looked at my alcoholism and saw the truth of my alcoholism. You say, the truth will set you free? Well, first it will irritate the hell out of you. And when I saw my alcoholism, it was never the same. I drank twice after that, but it was never the same. Once you see that truth, it isn't the same. That night in my living room, I stood naked in front of my life. And I realized that my life was the way it was because I designed it the way it was. I sounded like a guy who wanted to quit gambling. I wanted to gamble whenever the hell I wanted to gamble, for as much money as I wanted to gamble, and not have problems because of gambling. I wanted money without work. I wanted my wife's and children's love and affection without spending time with them. Not a good design. And that night I realized that I had tried pretty darn hard, almost to the best of my ability, to clean my act up, and I had failed. And for whatever reason, an answer came back and said, maybe that's okay. Maybe you're right where you're supposed to be. And I was allowed to take the 6th and the 7th step of the program of AA. The 6th step said that we're entirely ready to have God remember the defects of character. The 7th step said we humbly ask him to remember our shortcomings. I'd spent 8 years trying to get rid of them. I don't have the power to get rid of them. I'm responsible, but that happens through me, not by me. I am the pipe, not the well. A doctor doesn't heal. He creates an septic environment, creates an atmosphere in which healing can take place, and God heals. A farmer doesn't grow. He plants a seed and creates a fertile environment, an atmosphere in which growth can take place, and God grows, and we don't change. We create an atmosphere in which change can take place, and God changes us. We maintain an attitude of the 3 requirements of being honest, open-minded, and being willing, and maybe the attitude of the 6th and the 7th step, and we are changed in the process. The spiritual actions change us. We are transformed in that process. And that night I got down on my knees out of fear of getting drunk, but mostly out of fear of just being a sober asshole. And took the 6th and the 7th step, and 4 of the major problems that were in my life disappeared that night in my living room. Such is the power of AA, and such is the power of God, and such is the power of the 6th and the 7th step. Now, sometimes when people hear me talk, they say, that's right, the sixth and the seventh step, God, I haven't done enough work. I'm going to go back to the sixth and the seventh step. I think the reason I was able to take the sixth and the seventh step at depth that night is because I had just done 1 through 5. I don't think you can go in isolation to the sixth and the seventh step. I think I had to. One of the things that's going on today, I'm just wandering all over the place. One of the things that's going on today is there's so much teaching on the steps in the book today than there ever has been. It wasn't quite like that when I came in. And I think that's better, and I think it's fine, but there's some mischief in it. And one of the mischiefs in it is that you get the impression that it's almost mechanical. You know, all you got to do is memorize 164 pages and you're home free. Well, there's a lot of people that have got the book memorized that I'm not very impressed with. Wouldn't want to go on a fishing trip with them. That is the menu. It is not the food. It is the instructions, but it is not the action nor the experience. It is not that simple. There is nothing wrong with teaching it. There is nothing wrong with studying it. There is nothing wrong with memorizing it. But you have to do the work. And in the doing of the work, we change and we are altered. That night in my living room, I'm the kind of guy that when I go on a diet, the first thing I do is I buy a bag of cookies and buy a quart of ice cream. It's already been a bad day. All I'm going to do is finish off the day, and I'm probably never going to have ice cream again anyway. So, you know, it is... But I knew that I'm a guy who makes a lot of promises, and I knew that I had something significant that happened to me that night, and I might have to put a structure in place to support my decision to have God remove my defects of character. The next day, I turned the checking book over to my wife. My wife did not have the ego issues with money. She had us out of financial trouble in about 9 months. She could pay a third of a bill. Damnedest thing I had ever, never occurred to me. Never occurred to me you could pay a third of a bill. Thought they, you know. I made appointments with my sponsor about when I'd go to work and how long I'd stay at work and what I'd do at work. I quit gambling that night. I started dating my wife. I've dated my wife. The last couple of years has fallen down. I think we need to reinitiate that. But I dated my wife for 28 years every Friday night. It was a real, live, dangerous date. No one else went out with us. We got dressed up. We went out to a movie or went out and had a couple of drinks and a dinner. And, you know, we had fallen into a trap where we were talking about kids and money and bills, not how we fell in love. We had to get back to being romantic and go to Chicago and shack up for the weekend and start doing some stuff that added some romance and interest in our relationship. That was maybe the best thing we ever did. Because she was complaining about how active I was. And all of a sudden she knew and I knew that one day a week we had each other's undivided attention. And it made up for a lot of busyness that was in our lives. And it was really a good thing. I have spent thousands of dollars and hundreds of hours trying to learn how to be a better parent. I think being a parent takes 125% of whatever you got. Having kids is like having a bowling alley installed in your head. It is a profound experience, but it stretches you. My life took off like it was on a rocket ship. All of a sudden, the guy who couldn't work could work. All of a sudden, I was in the real estate investment business, and it was a fortuitous time to have that happen to me. And all of a sudden, I made enough money in the next 10 years to burn a wet elephant. And I have a partner who's 40 years sober, and we've been partners for 32 years. For the next 10 years, everything I touched turned to gold. Bought the big house, had a big Mercedes and a little Mercedes, and that was my deeply shallow period. And if there are problems with failure, which I had thoroughly examined, there are problems with success. And now all of a sudden I'm the guy in the $1,000 suit and the expensive tie driving to the meeting in my Mercedes thinking God has blessed me because of what a wonderful member of AA I was. How would you like to be in my meeting? that arrogance was invisible to me. I did not see it. I thought it was gratitude. It was invisible to me. 1986, they passed the Tax Act, and I started to go broke. Between 1986 and 1991, I lost $8 million and gained 40 pounds. I was going to write a book, but I've had trouble finding a publisher. Losing my money was not like changing my clothes. It was like tearing the skin off my body. I had prayed to be successful. I had prayed to be a millionaire. It never occurred to me to pray to keep it. Just before I started to go broke, I asked a man to be my spiritual director, and he said, "What do you want?" And the short version is that I want to be less materialistic and more loving. And within about 6 months, I started to lose everything I had. And I said, "We got to talk." I said, "What I really meant is I want to be more, you know, less materialistic, but I don't want to lose the stuff." You know, I was. We laugh about that today. Because I wouldn't trade the money for the lesson. I'd take the money and the lesson. but I wouldn't trade the money for the lesson. I don't think God had the real estate collapse to teach me a lesson, but I think within every horrible experience in our lives, there's an opportunity to learn something, and that most of us learn more at the difficult times than we do during the good times. I think the good times we go to sleep, most of us, and the tough times the pain pushes us to do something about it. And once again, when you're in more trouble, I got more active. And that was about the time Peter came home. Bill had already been in AA. Peter came home, got drunk, got arrested for drunken driving, towed a lot of an automobile, and ended up in detox. It was kind of his Christmas present to my wife and I. And this is as good a time as any. That grandchild that we just had was my son Bill. My son Bill got sober when he was 20 years old. No, when he was 18. And never took another drink. Went and lived in Europe for 4 or 5 years. He come back, got an MBA at Columbia, and he's happily married, and his wife is sober 5 years, and it's just wonderful. Peter, who was just a scary little kid, he and Danny were just, you know, we were just pleased when he was out of jail. And Peter was my payback. Peter looked like me, sounded like me. I mean, I thought they had, you know, he looked like they let the air out of me. I mean, he was like a replay. And wouldn't you think raising a child like you would be easier than raising, you know, that was the hard. Peter was the one I was the most physical with and the most inappropriate with. Last week, Peter got accepted to go to business school at Oxford University in England. Impossible. And Danny, our 23-year-old, attention deficit, learning disability, for all practical purposes, never got a high school education. He was always in a put off someplace. And he's 6 years sober, and he's in his second year of college. He's 23 almost, you know. It doesn't happen all at once. You know, it took Danny 5 or 6 years to gain the maturity and the engagement in his own life and the responsibility in his own life to engage. And you just watch it. I remember my parents just were looking for a pattern that looked like it was going to work. You know, I love what a wise man once told me. He said, parents want to know two things from their kids. One is that they love you. And the other is that their lives work. Because when you get those two messages, your job's done. If you withhold one of those two messages, your parents are kind of always on the hook. And so it's been an extraordinary trip. I have spent, you know, most of my adult life in Alcoholics Anonymous. Life was always kind of a mystery to me because I was a pretty well-equipped guy. As a friend of mine said, I was born on third base and congratulated myself for hitting a triple. I mean, my life, you know, I had a pretty good head start, guys, and didn't do much with it. And for whatever reason, it took me a long time to grow up. It took me until I was 30 years old to kind of get in the game. It took me until I was 8 years sober to kind of mature enough that I became responsible for my life to get in touch with the fears, which was, you know, and that second surrender that I had at 8 years, I don't find that so unusual. I find that to be the case. I think that most people who have a reasonable dose of alcoholism and drug dependency sometime between 5 and 15 years, their pants catch on fire. I think we come in here and we come in the program and we surrender, and many of us make extraordinary changes in the first 2 years of our lives, and then we kind of plateau out. And we don't have the insider depth to deeply look at the causes and conditions. And life is relentless. Life is lived in relationship, and your relationships to your parents and to your children and to your job will start to present you with you. And that's the rub. And it presents you with the unworkability of your life, and most of us don't want to look at that. If I were to ask everybody in the room, and I'm not asking you to raise a hand, but I said if I was going to ask you to raise a hand, I said, how many people would like to get rid of the things that don't work in their lives and hurt other people? I think most of us would raise our hands and say, yep, sign me up. But one of the things I discovered in my middle sobriety was that wasn't as true for me as I thought it was. It was true, you know, I was conflicted. A lot of the problems that I had in my life were my answers. They were my tools. I used anger as a tool. Not a very attractive tool, but it's a tool. I used gambling as a, you know, I played backgammon and I didn't lose. I won. So gambling was not a money problem. Gambling was a work problem, was an ethical problem, was a moral, you know, I mean, I was a slob, but I was a successful gambler. If there is such a thing. And pretend for a moment that I'm helping a guy who's 35 years old, married with children, who's trying to do a four-step, and he's having trouble doing a four-step. And he comes to me, and he wants some help. And I say, look, you're having trouble with the columns. I said, that's pretty tough stuff. I said, don't bother with that. I got a new idea. I said, go get your mom and dad and your wife and your kids and your boss, your brother and your sister, and a couple of neighbors, and bring them over to the house. And and here's what I'd like you to say to them. Just say, we have a step in AA where we try to get in touch with our defective character, and I'm having trouble identifying mine. And I was wondering if you'd help. And then just pass out tablets and leave. You'd have a pretty good start. But most of us wouldn't call that meeting. You know why? We don't want to change. We're afraid of change. But it's even worse than that. We don't want to know. When I came in AA, during my third to my eighth year, I tried to change and I failed. I tried and failed, I tried and failed, I tried and failed, but I still grew. But there comes a time where if you don't change, you stop growing. Apologies don't work anymore. You got to change. You can't go over to your kids and say, I'm sorry I did that for the 32nd time. You have to change. And if you don't change, you got a choice. Either get into the work and change, or you build an addition onto your house to accommodate the problem. Gamblers hang out with the gamblers, chasers hang out with the chasers, and you make a deal. I won't call you on your crap, you don't call me on mine. Deal? We'll talk about the steps, we'll talk about the traditions, we'll go to AA. You stay out of my face, I'll stay out of yours. Deal? Bad deal. Not the deal you want to make. You want to make the opposite deal. You want to make the deal where it says, if I'm really out of line, would you give me a call, a nice call? You don't have to be crappy about it, but I'd like a call that says you're worried about me. That's a better deal. There's a guy who wrote a book called, Road Less Traveled, and then he wrote another book called Further, Scott Peck wrote another book called Further Along a Road Less Traveled. And in that book, he has a chapter on death and dying. It's called The Road to Omaha. And he talks about Elizabeth Kubler-Ross's five stages of death and dying, you know, denial, anger, bargaining, depression, and acceptance. And he talks about the doctor gives you a diagnosis, you got cancer, and you think, denial, maybe I don't have it, and I get a second opinion. Anger is, why the heck is this happening to me? you know, bargaining is, God, please remove this and I'll dedicate my life to you. And depression is, I'm not trying to play doctor now, I'm not talking about a clinical depression, I'm talking about a depression appropriate to the circumstances that you're in. And then he says, but if you allow depression to do its work, which in my experience is to grind the ego to dust, you go through depression into acceptance. Now he said, when we talk about the phase of death and dying, most of us assume that everybody who dies goes through those five phases, but they don't. They go through denial, anger, and bargaining, but when they get to the depression, the pain's so great that they back away and recycle into denial, anger, and bargaining. And he says, it is similar, that path is a similar path that most of us go through in dealing with major changes in our lives. We don't view change like change, we view it like death. We so identify with certain issues in our lives, we don't think it's what we do, we think it's who we are. It isn't who we are. It is simply behavior. You can change your behavior, and it won't change who you be. When I said there's a lot of talk about the mechanics of the program, you get the impression that all you have to do is say the third step prayer and click your heels, and you'll be back in Kansas. It would be, if that were true, that's all you'd have to do. But a lot of times you say that prayer, and no one's home. Now, I'm not telling you not to say that prayer, and I'm not even telling you not to say the prayer mechanically. Saying it mechanically is better than not saying it. But when we do the steps are about being, not doing. The steps change who we be in that process. And once we change who we be, we start to change what we do. It is a transformation. It is not linear. It is of God. Because it's of God, it's very difficult to explain. You can point to it, but you can't contain it. No one owns it. No one's got it all down. No one does it perfectly. No one is problem-free. That's not a support of problems, but no one is problem-free. We need to know that. We need to know that we are active today in Alcoholics Anonymous to take the principles that are in the steps and apply them to our life to live. And that we have a complete answer, not a partial answer. Our answer isn't abstinence. Our answer is, once you're abstinent, get involved in the steps. Take the steps to the best of your ability, and you aren't going to take them perfectly. Just take them to the best of your ability, take them seriously, and as you do that, they will become part of the fabric of your life and who you be. And change, you know, on page 85 of the book, I don't have the book up here, but it talks about, it's happened automatically. It's like the problem's been removed. I haven't done anything. It's been done for me. That's the process of change. What happens? What does our book say? Haven't had a spiritual awakening. The process of taking the steps is you become more awake. When you become more awake, you're more conscious. When you're conscious, you see things that you don't see before. I still am a person who has issues with anger, but I'm more awake today. I don't strike children. I am not inappropriate. I have the same tendencies for money spending and different sorts of things than I do, but I don't do it to the extent that I used to do it, and I don't hurt people to the extent that I used to hurt it. I'm not perfect, but I'm in the game. I got a helmet. I am not just a coach. I am not just a teacher. I am actually trying to do these things in my life, and that's a path. You don't get well alone. You get well, you know, in a village. In the village, you need teachers. You need children. You need new people. You need old people. You need the message. And when I came in, I got the message, I got the book, but I got the book through the people that were in the program. I got it through their lives. I didn't get it just by someone spouting it. And I don't want to sound like I'm too much on that. I don't want to be on that. I think the teaching's good. But I got it watching how they live their lives. They really put these principles in action in their lives all the way. I saw it was different, and I was taught that way. And I hope that we keep that alive, that we don't get to a point where we're, you know, banging the book so much that we use it like people, like we sometimes think that people use the Bible to say, if you're not doing it this way, you're not a good person, you're not a good AA, you're not okay. There are going to be times when we're not doing it good. That's life. You just are going to stick it in the dirt once in a while. It's just the way it is. It isn't, recovery is not the absence of problems. Recovery gives us an opportunity to interact with our lives and be sufficient to whatever circumstances go into our lives. It doesn't make you a bad person. It makes you a human being. And if you're going to be... One of the hardest things in life is maintaining a lifetime relationship with anything. A child maintaining a lifetime relationship with their parents. That's going to have three or four seasons in it. A parent maintaining a lifetime relationship with their children. Ever-changing. With your company. With your sponsor. Everybody changes sponsors today with a rapidity that we didn't used to. You didn't used to have to have a perfect sponsor. You know, when you have a problem in a relationship, that's not just a message that you need to change, leave the relationship. It's a message that you need to enhance the relationship to resolve the problem. Same thing in your marriage. It isn't an idea that you're not supposed to be married. God's requesting, or the universe is requesting, that you enlarge your relationship is a crap eating machine. It is. If you're in a good marriage, you would be amazed at what a good marriage can digest. I'm serious. If you've got a good relationship with your sponsor, you'd be amazed at what a good relationship can digest. You live your life in relationship. Relationship is where you get presented with yourself. If God wanted to get a message to you, how the hell would he get it to you? Probably, bad news, your spouse. Or a look in your child's eye as you yelled at him. Or your boss. Or your coworker. So, the bad news is we have a disease that if you don't deal with it, it's going to kill you. The good news is in order to deal with it, you have to learn how to live. I feel like I'm a person who's been forced to enhance my life to a degree that is better than it ever would have dreamed of having it be had I not had the disease. I've been forced because of my weaknesses to take actions and to do things that has ended up making me a better person today and a person who hurts other people less than I ever would have been had I not had the disease. Thank you for my life.